great to be with you this week. Welcome back to another edition of Charting the Course. I am thrilled to be joined today by Jordan Dean and Kyle Ray, two members of our advisory team. Kyle has been on the podcast, so you may be familiar with his voice. Jordan, it is your first time, and we are thrilled to have you in the podcast room.
Thank you. I'm excited.
So I had this crazy idea that I kind of halfway want to make fun of our industry a little bit, and Jordan and Kyle are sitting here, and they're like, what are we doing? What are we talking about? But they've agreed to sit down and help me out with this conversation. So Jordan and Kyle, I appreciate it. Thank you both. What I want to do is, in our industry, and I'm sure this is, we could talk about the energy industry, or we could talk about the medical industry, but there's so many terms and terminologies and new terms and old terms, and it just gets thrown around like crazy. And I don't know about you guys, but I will talk to clients or other investors, friends, and they may be sophisticated in the sense of like they understand investing, but there's still times when they're like, you guys say this fill in the blank all the time. What in the world are you talking about? But there are some on here that are really funny, thanks to Jordan and some of her acronyms we're going to go over. But let's look at some of these real quick. Think investing 101 or terminology 101, because I do think some people are afraid to ask questions sometimes. Like, you guys say all this, but what are you talking about? The first one I wanted to talk about, probably the easiest one, we'll start with a softball question. But when you guys explain this to a potential investor, a current client, how does it go? And the two terms I want to start with are mutual funds and ETFs. Kyle, I'll kick it to you.
Sure.
How do you explain that?
Sure. So a mutual fund or an ETF, I'll start with a mutual fund.
Okay.
These two terms are sometimes used simultaneously. They are simply investment vehicles.
Similar vehicles
for how you can get exposure to a certain asset class, certain basket of stocks. So that's essentially what this is. A mutual fund is a basket of stocks. It can own an entire index like the S&P 500, or it can be very specific to a sector like the technology sector.
Right.
An ETF is similar, but could have some advantages. It is a basket of stocks or fixed income bonds that tracks a specific sector or an index as well. But there's a few differences here. So a mutual fund trades once a day. So it trades anywhere from after market hours. So anywhere from 3 o'clock to basically 7 or 8 o'clock at night. It reprices once a day. And as an investor, if you decided to get in or out on that specific day, you get the
market
price that day at market close
price, right? Okay.
Where an exchange traded fund is a little different is, and this is one of the, there's a handful of differences here, but the big difference is that an ETF is traded on an exchange. It moves throughout the day during normal market hours. So your price at 10 a.m. could be different than what you get at 2 p.m.
There's some price fluctuation as if you would see an individual stock price, correct?
One other consideration and difference here between a mutual fund or ETF, and again, they're both baskets of stocks or whatever they're tracking. It could be a basket of bonds as well,
right?
Is tax efficiency. So not to go too deep here, but mutual funds, they are technically registered investment companies all on their own, and they have to pass off capital gains taxes or losses, so basically consequences at the end of the year to their investors, whereas exchange traded funds are a more tax efficient vehicle that passes off some tax benefits to the end user, the client.
For instance, if you had an active mutual fund that's a growth mutual fund, let's say you buy that fund in October of this year, and by the end of the year, all of a sudden you receive a capital gain report from the mutual fund, but yet you made no other trades. You haven't sold the fund. Well, that happens, to Kyle's point, because the fund management inside of the portfolio is making changes. They're buying and selling the companies that they're choosing to put inside that growth mutual fund. So the tax efficiency is, again, something you've heard us preach about. But no, I think, Kyle, that's a great explanation. I think most people understand that, but still, it's just a good reminder of, okay, mutual fund, think a lot of times more active management, unless it's an index mutual fund, which you explained. And then ETF, think more just tracking an index. And that index could be whatever. It could be an energy index ETF. But okay, great.
I think one more thing to add just really quick here on these two terms is mutual fund is something that was very popular kind of starting in the 70s out to the 80s, 90s. If you didn't pick individual stocks as an investor, you were more than likely in mutual funds. And that was in big part to Vanguard and the rise of the mutual fund on that front. You've seen a real rise in popularity of ETFs over the last 20 years or so just because of the tax efficiency. And in fact, You see more and more companies every year that are re-registering their mutual funds into ETFs because it's a more popular thing. It's a little easier for clients to get in and out. It's more tax efficient. So that's certainly the way the investing world is moving. And I'd be curious to see kind of where we go from here and what that looks like in another 30 years.
Okay. Let's look at a couple other ones. These are two we internally say all the time, and I have to catch myself making sure that I'm explaining it properly. But these two terms are diversification and asset allocation, and because we deeply, deeply believe in the benefit there. So do you guys have any just kind of high level examples of how you break those terms down to clients?
Sure. Yeah. So diversification can mean a couple different things. So to paint a good example here, if someone might own one stock or two stocks, Apple, Microsoft, you know, I'll name just a few big ones, simply owning more stocks than just that could be diversification. The diversification that we kind of preach here is the diversification within asset categories. So you've got your stocks and you've got all your, you know, your 12,000 kind of global stocks and your options within that. Getting broad diversification on that front, we preach often. But then outside of just that asset class, talking about stocks, you've got diversification away from stocks. You've got fixed income, you've got alternatives. You can go down the list. You can kind of get lost there. But tying an asset allocation to diversification, asset allocation at a high level is picking your kind of your combination of your stocks, your bonds, your alternatives, and then whatever else you might layer in there. But that those two work together. But you know, someone that has an asset allocation of 60% stocks and 40% bonds, that 60% exposure to stocks could be all made up in one stock, and then you could have one bond hypothetically, and that would be an asset allocation for sure, but that would not be diversification. So those are two different terms.
I think that's perfect. You can have an asset allocation and not be diversified.
Highly concentrated asset allocation.
There's another one that we talk about a lot. You are highly concentrated.
Yeah. I think I hear people always say, I'm a 60-40 or I'm a 70-30. And, you know, do we really know what we're talking about? We're defining your asset allocation, but.
Well, I think from your seats, when you both are sitting in front of clients, why is that so important to have that conversation though? Why do we, we're talking about these terms that get thrown out, but what's so impactful about having that asset allocation conversation? What do you guys tie that into? How do you get these clients and these investors to really start thinking about it?
I think for me, I'll start with asset allocation. All of our new relationships with clients start with a very thorough asset allocation discussion. Asset allocation, the target asset allocation that you set for a client, whether that's 100% stocks, 40%, 60% stocks, whatever that kind of headline number is, that drives your long-term return. And that drives also the combination of, and the blend of stocks and bonds that you're going to have drives also your volatility. Not to throw in another word here that we might get to later on. But those two things are so integral to the long-term expected return for what, you know, an asset allocation has given a client. So we start there for what the needs of the client are. And then, you know, making sure, you know, our clients are preaching diversification underneath the asset allocation is also so important. The diversification, you know, not owning just, you know, 5 to 10 stocks in your stock portfolio, but owning, you know, all of them.
A lot.
All the good ones, all the bad ones has a huge impact to your long-term return as well. But every conversation that we have with clients or prospective clients starts with an asset allocation discussion, which without naming a lot of the other words on our list here that we will talk about, they all kind of come together and are important.
Yeah. I think as long as we're getting to know our clients, we can really hear their story. We can understand what their goals are long-term and short-term so that we can better set that and meet those short-term and long-term goals with the appropriate asset allocation at the time.
You both answered the question in the way that I think was perfect, because I think, one, we have to understand what their long-term kind of view is. And then Jordan, you hit on the head, what short-term and long-term goals, we got to make sure we're meeting those. We can have a understanding of every single one of these terms and be the smartest people in the room, but if we don't have the goal set right, it doesn't matter. So no, that's perfect. Okay, let's look at a fun one. I have been educated on this. This is part of this. I'm sure you both have seen this at times, but just I think you see it in health and fitness, but you're starting to see it in finance where you have these social media finance influencers about here's what I did, how I retired when I was 35 and all this stuff. Two terms that Jordan, you helped explain to me was, I think I'm sure it probably came from one of those platforms, but one is Dink and the other one is Dinkwad. Please enlighten the listeners on what those are.
So everyone's kind of put into a category, whether you're single, you're in a single income home, you've got dual income, and how do you plan for that? So all these groups of people have been given this acronym. So a SINC is single income, no kids.
Okay.
A DINC is dual income, no kids. Then we can take it further. We can say, okay, you're single income, no kids yet. So now you're a SINC-y. Then taking the dual income, no kids further, you're, you know, let's say you're newly married, you don't have kids, but you want some soon. So you're now a DINC-y, dual income, no kids yet. In my case, I'm a SINC wad. So I'm a single income, no kids with a dog. So
shout out Blanche.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is so funny. Just a side note here. If you are a parent and you have a young adult in the house and they hashtag SINC wad, it's okay.
Yep.
They're just a single income, no kids with a dog.
Yep.
Rest easy.
Yeah. And they're talking about their finances. So we're on the right track.
DINC life. I've seen that. It's like, oh my goodness. I think those are hilarious though, but it is funny to watch this next generation come up with these things that 20, 30 years ago, you just said it. Oh yeah, I'm single, no kids. And so that's my, you know, my financial picture. But now there's terms and it's or a whole group of people.
And as planners, it puts us in a good position. If someone comes in and they already know they are a dual income family, they don't have kids, but they want some soon. How do we plan for that?
Yeah.
And what does that look like?
Oh, absolutely. I just love that there's a term to it now. So
yeah, I learned what these were. Other than I knew what DINC was, but I did not know what DINC wad was. So Jordan has been helping us today.
So she's so much cooler than us. You know, another one, and we say this all the time, and we do explain it. I think we do a good job of it, but that's fiduciary. And I mean, oh my word, our industry throws us around like crazy. There may or may not be a commercial. The company rhymes with Swisher. And the man may or may not use his hands all the time. The commercials have done a good job of explaining what a fiduciary is. It's an important term because it does differentiate a firm like ourselves where the client's interest comes first and a firm like a brokerage house where they're not bad people. They're good people. They just are able to have products that they sell. And so it has to make sense for the client. Sure, but it can absolutely also be a product that their management team is pushing out because they want to sell a lot of it, right? So do you have any, as you both have, you know, years of experience in the finance industry, explaining this term, do you get tired of it? What are some differentiators you have made in the past? Just a few comments around fiduciary.
I think it's a great term. It is used, from what I observe, is it's even used pretty loosely now by firms who aren't legally fiduciaries.
Or like David says, they can put on both hats.
Right, and, right.
Yeah.
I always kind of equate it back to other industries that have fiduciaries as well. So if you think about attorneys, for example, if you hired an attorney, they are a fiduciary for you. They legally have to put your interest in front of their own. You're hiring them to do a certain task. That is the same legal term of what we're speaking about here. And there are a number of investment firms that are like that and structured like that. I would say there's more and more every day, but it's a great thing for the client to know that the firm you're working with is actually a legal fiduciary, not just someone who might throw that term around kind of loosely.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. A lot of people say that they are, and then their actions say differently.
Yeah.
And it's very nice to be somewhere that you can say you're a fiduciary and you mean it. And everything that you do, everything that you say, your client's needs are above your own.
Yeah.
And it makes it a lot more transparent.
Yeah, I think it's comforting for the client to know that there is no incentive for Full Sail or any other fiduciary firm to place or try to sell you an asset to put in your account that's going to pay them more or some incentive fee.
Right.
And that everything that the firm that you're working with or is working for you is only incentivized to hopefully make the best decision for you over a long period of time that's going to pay off for you. Yeah. And that's pretty comforting.
Which is why you've seen a lot of firms go to AUM fees. And this is on our list. We don't need to spend a ton of time here, but just again, asset under management fees, because that aligns our interests. We're on the same side of the table. We want to see your account grow. Our fees tied to your account growing. And by the way, that fee schedule has tiers. So as your account grows, your overall fee percentage goes lower. And at a certain point, what we do is we actually cap that percentage at a level that we feel makes sense. AUM fees, again, just a reminder, closely tied with that fiduciary service. Real quick, before we move kind of the second half of our conversation, the other term that I wanted to spend some time on that gets thrown around a lot is basis points. I mean, I know how I articulate it, but what do you guys do?
Sure. I'll even take it a step further since we're on the basis point discussion. But just to explain real quick, one basis point is 1/100th of a percent. So
what would 1% be?
Yeah, 1% would be 100 basis points. Okay. And to confuse us even more, and you're hearing this a lot with like Fed discussions right now and the potential of them decreasing rates. The Fed usually always speaks in basis point or BIPs discussion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. BIPs is simply short for basis points. So they're talking about doing a potential 25 or 50 BIP cut. That's 25 or 50 basis points. That's 1/4 of 1% or 1/2 of 1%. So that's kind of how the numbers equate and line up. Yeah. So 100 BIPs is 1%, 200 BIPs is 2%.
Not as cool as DINK, but
yeah,
it's up there.
Yeah.
BIPs
yeah,
is pretty
BIPs
cool.
Is pretty
I like
cool.
I like using BIPs, but sometimes you do have to explain that.
Yeah.
See, so now you know. At your next dinner party, just be like, man, can you believe that 25 BIP cut? Room will be rolling, I promise. We've had some fun. I just kind of wanted to take a minute and go over some of these terms. Thanks for entertaining me there in my rabbit hole of terms. And again, there's others we didn't even bring up. Expense ratio, rebalance, risk tolerance and volatility. I mean, holy cow, that's an annuity salesman's dream right there is risk tolerance and volatility. But I know that a majority of people know the ins and outs of all these terms, but I just think it's good to refresh and go back and be like, listen, you shouldn't feel dumb because you don't understand what they're talking about when they're like, yeah, the Fed cut by 50 bips or the Fed raised rates by 50 bips or what a dink is. It's all good. Let's transition though. One of my favorite Warren Buffett quotes is pertaining to disciplined investing behavior. And he has so many. I mean, it's awesome. But this is what he says. He says the most important quality for an investor is temperament, not intellect. Now, before all of my CFAs and CFPs and CPAs and really smart people get mad at me, it's not that we shouldn't have intellect in the world, but for an investor, again, the most important thing for them to do is that temperament. It's understanding their behavioral biases, understanding what's going to trip them up, understanding that they can or cannot watch the news on a daily basis. What are you guys telling your clients right now? What conversations are you having with friends and family around the investing behavior side of things? Like, what would you encourage people over the next, let's just call it the next 2 to 3 months to focus on?
I mean, I've always wanted to say just you're along for the ride. The ride's going to be rough. We may have some ups and downs. We may turn upside down, but long term, we're always up and to the right. So
up and to the right's where we want to be.
Up and to the right's where we want to be.
Yeah. When we do that, we're not saying up and to the right in the next quarter.
Right.
We're saying over a market cycle, or I don't know how you explain it, but I usually say over a lengthy period of time up and to the right. You know, Zach always says, if you're putting money in the equity market, then you're not worried about who the president is the next 4 years. You're more focused on the fact that there's probably going to be 2 or 3 different presidents over the course of your equity investing timeline. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, something we've already talked about, and we talked about it when we went through our terms, is just focusing on that high level asset allocation for each client. That asset allocation should theoretically fit their short-term goals in the form of if they need income, if they need to live out of the portfolio, but it also should meet their long-term goals, which inevitably means outpacing inflation or keeping up with inflation, maybe some legacy goals. But I think the most important job that an advisor has, and I agree with Morgan Housel, he came on our podcast a few years ago and talked about this, is that our job is to really keep our clients focused on the goal and less about what's happening on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you think about what the average investor and kind of the middle road asset allocation investor, what they've seen over the last 5 years or 7 years, they've gone through incredible ups and downs. But if you look at the long-term kind of picture, when I say long-term, I kind of think 5 years plus, they've hit the expected annual return that the market and the bond market layered together has always provided. Yeah. But it's never your expected return 7% and you're going to get 7% every year. It's not going to happen. You're up 20, you're down 10. I think the jobs that we have on the front end with clients and just preparing them for volatility is so important because we can't get around it and no one can if you're taking risk as an investor.
Sure. A lot of coaching that we do, not in the sense of, you know, we're telling people what to do, but more so just talking it through, talking to them. What are you worried about? We were talking the other day in one of our staff meetings that, you know, typically if we're proactive in calling some of our investors that we know are more prone to be nervous than others, typically if we reach out and we talk to them first, by the end of the conversation, they're talking to us about their kids or their grandkids and what's going on. And they are reassured simply by the fact that we're focused on their goals. We know what's going on. We've got a plan in place. Nothing's changed in that plan. So again, I just think that's really important.
I think if you think of just going back a few years, you know, investors who started January 1 of 2022, whether you were in 100% stocks or 100% bonds, you got really beat up that year. But if you saw it through, held to your asset allocation, you've been really rewarded for it. Although it's easier said than done. It's easy to sit here and say you wouldn't sell out when you're down 10 or 15%, but actually holding on efficiently, tax loss harvesting, doing the things that can add value on the way down, doing that just provides so much value and allows you to compound on the way up. And I think people have been rewarded for that, but that's really our job as advisors, is keeping people and clients to that longer term picture. And although I know a 2% drop today is scary and it feels like things are ending, that it doesn't really matter because you have to outpace inflation for the next 40 years. We don't necessarily care what happens today.
Yeah. So Jordan, off air, we were talking about discipline. Let's go there for a minute.
An advisor's role is to make sure that we're explaining and educating what volatility looks like and what it's looked like over a long period of time to our clients. And people come in with knowing a lot about the market or nothing at all.
We have to meet people where they are.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Where are they coming from? A client that has been quote unquote wealthy for 20 years, that's a different conversation with them about the next 20 than somebody that just sold a business that now all of a sudden they're in a whole different situation, whole different life outlook, if you will. We got to meet them where they are. We can't have, those are different conversations.
Right. I think in our world that's dominated, no offense, Zach or Austin or any of the guys that are about to be CFAs or will be CFAs in the future, we're dominated by a lot of smart people who tell you all the reasons why you should do exactly this. And this is where the advisor who really knows the client, knows their family, knows their biases, knows their goals. That's why the advisor is so important, because you can have two clients. One could be a brother and sister who own a business together. They have plenty of money. They have the same amount of assets with the firm. And this is a hypothetical client, but it's not all that hypothetical. I see it every day. One client, you could tell them all the reasons that they have plenty of money and that they're not going to need to pull the money and that they should be as aggressive as possible and should be 100% stocks, because really, in theory here, they're investing for their kids and for their risk tolerance, not their own, for people who are leaving a legacy. You can tell them all the reasons why that person, why you should be 100% stocks. But if you can't lay your head on the pillow at night and be able to go to sleep because volatility is bothering you and eventually it's going to break you and you will direct us to sell out, that's more detrimental than us finding an asset allocation that brings that volatility down, dampens the volatility, allows you to sleep at night, full well knowing you may give up a little bit of return over a long period of time. But I think the peace in mind and the comfort is something only the advisor can offer, that because they know the client, they know their biases. It's not someone coming from a academic kind of viewpoint and telling you why you should do exactly this. Inherently, there's just a lot of biases and fears and greed in this business for clients. And getting an asset allocation that works for the long term and that allows them to sleep at night is just as important as trying to capture all the potential return you can get, you know, in any given year.
You know, one thing that I think about a lot is we are comfortable in the world that we live in, as in the three of us in this room, we're comfortable with the investing world because we understand it. And there are some people who are comfortable with commercial real estate, who are comfortable with residential real estate, who are comfortable with oil and gas. That's great. Like, you understand it. That's what you're comfortable with. So go do it. But trying to compare returns between those, like if you have a buddy who's in oil and gas, he made 15, 20% on his investment and you're sitting here and you've made 8 because of how you're allocated or how you're invested. Well, you guys have different goals.
Right.
And so it goes back again. We've talked about house a lot because we're talking about this investing behavior, but it all comes down to what's the goal of what you're trying to do. What is your goal? What are you trying to accomplish?
Yeah. I'll even take it a step further. A lot of our clients don't talk in percentage terms. They talk in dollar terms. So we can sit here all day and say, your account's down 3% or it's up 15%. What does that really look like?
How much dollars did I make,
Jordan? How many dollars is that? The math, I need the math to math, you know?
It's not mathing.
This isn't mathing. But I mean, we have to sometimes ask our clients, you know, what's it going to feel like when you look at your account and you see that you've lost $300,000 in any given time period? How are you going to feel when you see that? And then based on the behavior, the emotion, the feeling wrapped around that, we can have further discussions on, should we change something about your asset allocation? Tell me what bothers you so we can make your sleep at night more comfortable.
Right.
Yeah. I love it. We've been all over the place. Jordan, Kyle, I really appreciate it. Thank you for entertaining me. Everybody had a great week, and we'll be back with another episode next month. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week. All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.